Both Bob and Frank realized they were stealing time from the company. Bob thought,
you know, I should do some work. Nah, one more episode. They'll never find out.
But Frank went to his boss.
Sir?
Yes, Frank?
I have a confession to make.
When the president found out both Bob and Frank had wasted company time, who do you think got fired?
Mr. President, Frank talked to me about what he did. I promised him we'd work it out.
Okay, but fire Bob.
Like Bob and Frank, we have all done wrong and are subject to God's judgment. Have you gone to God about your wrongs? Or like Bob, are you hoping he won't notice?
A message from Lifeline Productions. 1-800-52-FUNNY at lifelinepro.com.
Years ahead of the dominant media, find out first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com, on satellite, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
In this day of economic uncertainty and soaring unemployment, safe investments are often hard to find. But investing in the precious metals is the safest investment of all, because gold and silver is real money. Government-printed currency is not. Call Melody Cederstrom at Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company at 1-800-375-4188. Melody has been helping people secure their financial future for over 10 years. While others in the business claim honesty, Melody will deliver. Give her a call, 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
Okay, we're back, and there's more of this Where This Came From. Myron Fagan is who we're listening to.
Welcome back to the second hour of American Exposé.
I'm Sam.
And I'm Trish.
And Myron Fagan is a playwright and a film author, and this guy was, man, I'll tell you what, this guy deserves, he deserved more medals and know what to do with. You know, there are some who fight for freedom in wars.
And not the upside down pentagram.
No, not the pentagram either, no. there are some people who fight for freedom through war, and then there are others who fight for freedom in the way that he did, and that was a kind of a war.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't use guns and bullets and missiles and stuff like that, but nevertheless, it was a war. And this man should be...
I'm sure he had a lot of help the way he talked.
Right up there. And, you know, it just goes to show you that patriots have had problems in this country for a long, long time, true patriots, longer than we care to admit. And, folks... It's a shame that this country has been allowed to go this long and this far. And now look what we got. We're staring the UN in the face with the UN Agenda 21. Chris has talked about that. And so we're in a real world of hurt because too many people let their guard down. And as he said, the apathy of the people and the amnesia of the people, I call it selective amnesia in a lot of cases, because people remember what they want to remember. Stuff that's frivolous, they remember, and stuff that's worth anything, they forget. And, like, they can tell you what their favorite football player is or their soft drink is, but they can't tell you anything about anything important. Anyway, let's continue on. Here's more of Myron Fagan.
I predicted that the press would not dare to ignore the facts that would be brought out at those hearings. But I also warned that both the press and the radio would go into complete silence after the hearings would close, and I warned my audiences against the tragic propensity of the people to forget. I also warned that the Reds never quit. One very wonderful result came out of my speeches and warnings. Under the leadership of Mrs. J. Henry Orme of the Ebell Women's Club, a very wonderful patriotic American woman, 100 presidents of women's clubs in Southern California, particularly in the Hollywood area, met and organized what they called Citizens United for American Principles. Those women's clubs' presidents agreed to serve as a committee of 100 directors of the organization, and they appointed Rupert Hughes, a famous writer and uncle of Howard Hughes, to serve as their advisory chairman. Their objective was as simple as it could have been highly effective. That objective was to urge all loyal Americans to boycott all movie theaters that would continue to show Red propaganda films and films employing the 300 Reds named and officially identified by the Congressional Committee. That would destroy the box offices of those theaters and thus destroy the revenues of all the Red conspiracy's producers. True, that might destroy the entire film industry, but it would also break the back of the entire Red conspiracy. To save themselves, it would force the producers to blacklist the named Reds out of all films. It would force them to abandon the making of Red propaganda films. As I stated, that objective could have been the cure for the Red conspiracy in Hollywood. But I promptly pointed out to that committee that their procedure was all wrong, that they were making their organization vulnerable to destruction by the enemy. By the enemy, I meant Motion Picture Producers Association and their chief ally, the notorious Anti-Defamation League. They asked me to explain how and why they would be so vulnerable. My explanation was very simple. The enemy would simply launch a campaign to terrorize the supermarkets and all other merchants to boycott the products of the husbands of that committee of 100 women. All those women scoffed. They said the enemy just would not dare to attempt such a boycott. Several days later, it happened. One of the committee, whose husband was the head of one of the largest dairy companies in Southern California, frantically withdrew her club from the organization because her husband's business was threatened by the very boycott scheme I had warned against. During the following 2 weeks, approximately 60 additional panicked members of the committee withdrew for the very same reason. In addition, Rupert Hughes, then in the late 70s, stated that the job of advisory chairman was too strenuous for a man of his age, and he resigned. Thereupon, Mrs. Orme and the remaining members of the committee called me into a meeting and asked me to tell them how they could carry on. They were determined not to surrender their objective. My advice was simple. Their objective was to educate all of the American people about the Red menace in Hollywood and unite them into destroying that menace. Therefore, the name of their organization must distinctly emphasize that objective. And I suggested a new name, the Cinema Educational Guild. Also to make the organization, CEG, invulnerable to the attacks of the enemy, the committee of the presidents of the women's clubs must be disbanded, and the names of the new directors of CEG and of the members of the guild must never be revealed. Thus, there would be no targets for the enemy except myself if I became the head of CEG, and I would be invulnerable. The enemy could do no more to me than they had already done. Mrs. Orme and the others agreed, and that was when and how the Cinema Educational Guild came into existence. And at this time, let me stress that ever since then, I have continuously been stressing that the Reds never surrender, that they never let go of anything they have in their grip, that when unmasked and cornered, they retreat, they smile, they offer to coexist. And I've continuously warned that the moment the victim lets down his guard, they, the Reds, pile in more ruthlessly than ever. The Moscow Reds confirmed all that in Hungary in 1956. Remember? In short, the Reds can't be licked. They must be destroyed. But there's only one way to do it, through their pocketbooks. There must be a nationwide boycott of all theaters that show films with red stars or films with red propaganda. Kill such films at the box offices and you will destroy the ammunition, money of the producers. The same is true of radio and TV in a different yet similar way. The moguls of radio and TV do not have to depend upon box offices for their revenue. They depend upon the sponsors who pay for the time to show their TV shows and commercials that advertise their products. A nationwide boycott of the products of such sponsors will quickly cure that disease. It will keep those red stars and red propaganda shows out of your living rooms. Shows that poison the minds of your easily influenced children. Time after time after time, we drove the Reds out of Hollywood. The people assumed that they had achieved a great and final victory, that the whole war had been won, and then they'd proceed to forget, and the Reds would come slithering back. There is absolutely no doubt that a fully alerted people can kill this Red conspiracy in Hollywood. Let's go back to that first hearing in Washington. The reactions of the suddenly aroused American people to the revelations at that hearing swept panic through all of Hollywood. Mayor Warner and all the other panic-stricken moguls piously vowed that they would immediately begin a drive to house-clean all Reds and Red traitors out of Hollywood. Of course, they lied. Despite their fright, those moguls had no thought of reforming. They merely determined not to be caught again. Actually, however, they couldn't have reformed even if they had truly wanted to, which they didn't. Because the real controls of Hollywood are firmly in the hands of such internationalist bankers as Lehman Brothers, Kuhn Loeb, Goldman Sachs, the Warburgs, etc., who financed practically all the big Hollywood lots, all of whom are directors and the top brass of the Council on Foreign Relations. The hierarchy of the great conspiracy. Practically every Hollywood lot, every national TV network, every national radio network was financed and is controlled by those internationalist bankers, and therefore all of them are controlled by the CFR. That entire story of the enslavement of our entire mass communications media and all their betrayals of the American people is fully revealed in our Illuminati CFR recordings. The brazen sham of all those promises and pious vows of the moguls at that first Washington hearing was clearly revealed after the infamous Hollywood Ten were released from prison. The moguls had faithfully promised that none of those ten would ever again be employed by Hollywood, but immediately after their release, all of them were restored to their old jobs under fictitious names and at double their previous salaries. Naturally, we, CEG, turned all that evidence over to the FBI and the Congressional Committee. But even more important, after about a year of disappearance from Hollywood, many of the congressional exposed stars, such as Frederick March, Gene Kelly, Humphrey Bogart, John Garfield, Edward G. Robinson, etc., were back on the lots and getting the best roles in Hollywood. We waited for action from the Congressional Committee, but no action came. So we, CEG, decided to do a job of reminding the people in our own way. I wrote, and CEG published, a book which I called Red Treason in Hollywood, in which I revealed the full story of the Red Conspiracy in the film industry, and I named all the top Red stars, writers, directors, and producers. That was the first time that such a complete and direct charge had ever been published, and so many of Hollywood's royalty named as traitors. The book created a sensation. It even caught the press off guard. Editorial writers and syndicated columnists, among them, believe it or not, Ed Sullivan, who acclaimed the book as a Bible for those who want the truth about conditions in Hollywood. Sullivan stressed that the author's background in the theater in Hollywood gave the book an authenticity that no outside writer could have provided. But our press holiday didn't last very long. The notorious Anti-Defamation League, who had previously warned me of dire consequences if I persisted in my exposition of the Red Conspiracy, came roaring into the battle. They issued an order, and all the Red, Pinko, and Liberal publications began a hysterical screaming of anti-Semitic, basing their screams on the fact that there was a heavy percentage of Jews among the Red traitors I had named in the book. The ADL did not deny that those individuals were Reds and traitors. That apparently did not matter. My crime was the naming of them. And within a matter of days, both the press and radio were completely closed to us, even for paid advertising. All bookstores and even libraries were terrorized into blacklisting the book. In addition, they terrorized the printer we had employed into refusing our reprint orders and into destroying all plates of the book. That has happened with all our books, and the moguls blithely continue to employ all the Reds and brazenly continued to issue Red propaganda films. Right then and there, I learned the answer for the red disease and the film industry. The blackouts by the press and radio kept the people completely in the dark about what was going on in Hollywood. True, that congressional hearing of 1947 had revealed it, but that was more than a year previously, and the tragic short memory of the people had made them forget all about it. So right then and there, we, CEG, adopted a new technique to break through that blackout. We organized picketing committees to picket the theaters showing the Red Stars and Red Propaganda films, to provide TNT ammunition for the pickets. We issued a special six-page tract which contained the salient features of Red Treason in Hollywood and a listing of the Reds. We made them available at the rate of $2 for 100 tracts, and they are still available. Within a few months, more than 2 million copies of that tract were in circulation throughout the nation. In Newark, New Jersey, a war veterans post had its members picketing the premiere of a new Charlie Chaplin film and killed it for the entire country. In Los Angeles, we picketed to death the Death of a Salesman and other Red films. In Chicago and other cities, the American Legion and Veterans of Foreign Wars did similar jobs. The press just could not or did not dare to ignore the picketings. And once again, our story became a front-page sensation. Theaters all over the country canceled their bookings of all the picketed films, and the panic was really on. The Frederick Marshes, Eddie Cantors, John Garfields, Orson Welles, and many of the Red Stars named in our tract became poison at the box offices. Receipts zoomed down in all theaters showing such stars. Theater owners all over the country began to scream, and that brought on another congressional investigation. That did it. 1947, my production of the play Thieves' Paradise had forced a congressional investigation of the Reds in Hollywood that sent the infamous Hollywood 10 to prison and drove many of the other unmasked Red Stars out of Hollywood. But within a year, the people had forgotten, and all the Reds came pouring back. Then early in 1949, our CEG new technique of picketing the theaters, combined with our Red Stars tract, reminded the people. And once again, the Reds were driven off the screen. But as I will show you, the short memory of our people again and again enabled the conspirators to restore the film as their great brainwashing propaganda weapon for our destruction. However, that second show of cleaning house by the moguls came almost too late for the film industry in Hollywood. During the following 2 years, the entire industry was in its greatest depression. Every month, hundreds upon hundreds of theaters were closing their doors, which meant alarmingly reduced revenues for the producers. By 1951, the situation was more than just acute. It appeared that the entire industry was headed for a big bust. Important stockholders were asking embarrassing questions, and more than merely hinting that changes at the top might be the cure. The moguls and their masters, the internationalist bankers, became more and more desperate. Something had to be done to bring the American people back to the box offices. The only way to accomplish that was by doing something to make the people once again forget about the Reds in Hollywood. Here is how they went about it. They resorted to an old trick. During the Depression years, 1929 to 1935, the surest cure for anemia at the box office was a personal appearance of a popular movie star. Many movie theaters owed their survival to that lure. So now the moguls decided to resort to that same technique to hoodwink the American people. Only this time they added a twist to it. In addition to appearances at theaters, the stars were to be honor guests at the luncheon meetings of women's clubs, Kiwanis, Rotary, Lions, and other civic and service groups. In addition, and that was the real gimmick, they were to entertain and address press conferences attended by all local editors and columnists and radio and TV commentators. And under strict instructions, the theme song of all those traveling goodwill ambassador stars was to be, "Communism has been cleaned out of Hollywood." I stress that under strict instructions because I know that many of the Loyal to America stars vehemently protested against that phony theme song. For one example, Clark Gable, the most popular of all the Hollywood stars, positively refused to serve as such an ambassador, and the moguls didn't dare to punish him for it. On the other hand, there were other Hollywood celebrities, and they were those who screeched Americanism the loudest, who jumped into the scheme with both feet. One of the most shameless of these renegades was Ronald Reagan, then president of the Screen Actors Guild, which at the 1947 hearings in Washington was proclaimed to be the most vicious hotbed of communists in the entire film industry. The same Reagan now is governor of California and a would-be candidate for the presidency. He toured the nation and spouted his brazen deceit on radio and on TV before all types of civic groups. And he didn't stop with the statement that communists and communism had been cleaned out of Hollywood. He assured the world that, quote, "today even the fellow traveler has disappeared from the Hollywood scene," end of quote. Now, in order to clear away all doubts and confusions about Reagan's hypocrisy and to show the depths of deceit to which he resorted, the following is a sample of one section of his spiel as it was published under his byline in Victor Reisel's column on July 27, 1951. Quote, "Communism," stated Reagan, "failed in Hollywood because the overwhelming majority of the Screen Actors Guild are and always have been opposed to communism. They, the Reds, tried every trick in the bag, but the actors, led by the board of directors of the Screen Actors Guild, outthought and outfought them. We fought them on record and off the record. We fought them in meetings and behind the scenes. Our Red foes even went so far as to threaten to throw acid in the faces of myself and other stars so that we never could appear on the screen again. I packed a gun for some time, and policemen lived at my home to guard the kids. But those days are gone forever, along with the deluded Red sympathizers and fellow travelers. Today, even the fellow traveler has disappeared from the Hollywood scene." End of quote. Now, bear in mind that the overwhelming majority of the Screen Actors Guild and Board of Directors mentioned by Reagan contained hundreds of the stars named in our Red Stars tract, all documented as Reds by the Congressional Committee and the California State Senate Fact-Finding Committee. That new theme song worked like a charm. As was to be expected, newspapers, magazines, radio, and TV picked it up and spread it throughout the nation. The liberal columnists and radio and TV commentators began to chorus it in their columns and broadcasts. They loaned their columns and their mics to Reagan and the other Hollywood goodwill ambassadors, and public opinion once again began to succumb to it. The people began to forget, and slowly but surely, the starving movie theaters, which had been showing the Red Stars and Red propaganda films, began to fill up again. By 1952, it seemed that all the people had forgotten, and Hollywood was on its way back to prosperity, and all the unmasked and banished Reds came flocking back onto all the Hollywood lots, and they again gleefully began to produce films with messages. And that was their great mistake. Had the moguls kept the banished Reds out of Hollywood 2 or 3 years longer, had they kept messages out of their films for 2 or 3 years longer, and continued their "today even the fellow traveler has disappeared from the Hollywood scene" theme song, they might well have succeeded in lulling the American people so deeply into slumberland that, figuratively speaking, only an earthquake would have awakened them. But the masterminds of the CFR are not concerned with the problems of their mogul tools and stooges. They want continuous action, continuous brainwashing, and the Hollywood moguls had to obey orders. Thus, even as their theme song, No More Reds in Hollywood, was ringing throughout the land, they again began to issue red propaganda film after red propaganda film, each one more brazen than the previous ones. We promptly issued another special bulletin in which we fully revealed the Hollywood mogul's new technique. We categorically listed all the new red films, and we highlighted the propaganda in them. We again named all the once-banished Reds who were back on the Hollywood lots. And we again stressed the return of the infamous Hollywood Ten into their old jobs and revealed the fictitious names under which they operated. Within 60 days, we had more than 200,000 copies of that special bulletin and more than 2 million copies of our updated Red Stars tract circulating throughout the country. And once again, theaters all over the country were being picketed. Once again, the House Committee on the Un-American Activities was being deluged with copies of the bulletin and tract, together with angry letters demanding action. And despite all pressures to prevent it, the committee publicly scheduled another Hollywood hearing. And lo and behold, once again, the press was forced to front page another parade of Hollywood celebrities to answer questions. Again, many of them, when asked the $64,000 questions, hastily sought refuge behind the Fifth Amendment. Others, realizing that we, CEG, had provided the committee with documentary evidence of their red activities, and fearing the consequences of perjury, such as had sent the Hollywood Ten to prison, confessed and named virtually all those we had listed in our Red Stars tract, many of whom were again holding down the best jobs on various Hollywood lots. Naturally, that torpedoed the Ronald Reagan Act. It also sank all the other Hollywood goodwill ambassadors. They all scurried back to Hollywood and into deep silence. And once again, all the Reds were in flight from Hollywood, back to Broadway in Europe. And this time they had a new sanctuary, television. But once again, hundreds of theaters all over the country were going out of business. Now you would think that that new debacle would have served as a final lesson for the moguls. But as I have been repeating for 20 years, they never quit. Actually, I repeat, they can't quit, even if they wanted to, because they are the slaves of the masterminds of the great conspiracy, the internationalist bankers of the CFR, who are concerned with nothing less than the complete brainwashing of the American people. So even as Hollywood was reeling from the latest exposure, once again the conspirators began to develop another new technique. And this time, they acquired some truly amazing cat's paws to do their job for them. It was a fiendishly clever scheme, which they figured would whitewash all their Reds and restore them as idols of the American people. It was a scheme that truly was Machiavellian. How Machiavellian is evidenced by the fact that the new cat's paws they chose to pull their chestnuts out of the fire were none other than our most highly trusted syndicated columnists. Columnists whose loyalty to everything American, until then, had been beyond question in the minds of all our people. When Ronald Reagan's, today even the fellow traveler has disappeared from Hollywood, pony act was unmasked, it was fully revealed that the press was, collectively, the major villain in the piece.
Okay, we're going to cut right there, and we've got a commercial break coming up, so stay tuned. You're listening to American Exposé. I'm Sam.
And I'm Trish.
And we'll be back right after these messages. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
A bird that never lands? One does exist. Learn more about it in today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moment's host, Ian Taylor.
The small bird known as the chimney swift is unmatched in its flying ability. These little birds are so adapted to the air that they have only small, weak feet that do not permit them to walk or perch like other birds. In fact, their Latin name even means without feet. When swifts do come to rest, they do so against a vertical surface like a wall. They are often found resting inside the protection of chimneys, which led to their English name, chimney swift. A large flock of swifts may sight a chimney and begin circling it in smaller and smaller circles. Finally, the birds closest to the chimney enter it, followed by the rest. One person reported seeing a flock of 10,000 swifts enter one chimney over a period of 37 minutes. When David was cursed by Shimei, he realized that the curse would be of no effect because he was innocent of murdering members of Saul's family. In Proverbs chapter 26, verse 2, his son Solomon compares unjust curses to a bird which never lands, meaning that when people speak evil of us or curse us, if what they say is untrue or unjust, their words will have no effect. It is God's wisdom to think of unjust things that are said about us as being like the swift, always in flight and never landing upon us.
To get a complete set of transcripts from Creation Moments programs, ask about the book Letting God Create Your Day when you visit us online at creationmoments.com. Join us again for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
Record budget deficits, bankruptcies galore, and the U.S. dollar is at an all-time low. With today's gloomy economic outlook, safe investments are often hard to find. For over a decade, Melody Cederstrom at Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company has been helping people secure their future by investing in the precious metals. Melody has the honesty, integrity, and experience that is often lacking in the precious metals business. Let her put it to work for you. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
Okay, we're back, and we're going to try to get through as much of this as we can. I don't think it's going to fit, but we're going to try.
You've gotten the most of it, really, but...
Yeah, so we're going to go ahead and start. Let's pick up with Myron Fagan and Red Stars Over Hollywood.
The major actors in that Ronald Reagan phony crusade were all the syndicated movie gossip columnists who had continuously, mawkishly rhapsodized over the fallen angels. Plus such columnists and radio TV commentators as Drew Pearson, the Alsops, Ed Murrow, Chet Huntley, Eric Severide, Howard K. Smith, etc. But all such journalists had long been unmasked as willing collaborators of the CFR Great Conspiracy, which of itself made it easy for us to unmask that entire theme song plot. But there is another group of columnists and commentators who, in those earlier years, wielded a tremendous influence on public opinion, who, in fact, molded public opinion. The best known of them were George Sikorsky, Fulton Lewis Jr., Westbrook Pegler, Victor Reichel, etc. The Reds derisively and bitterly referred to them as isolationists and vicious rightists, which clearly established them as loyal Americans in the minds of the American people. The vast majority of our people virtually revered them, regarded them as oracles, and blindly responded to every word they wrote or uttered. In the main, that was fine. In the main, I readily subscribed to the integrity of all in that group. And when they stuck to the things they knew, I wholeheartedly subscribed to their wisdom. But I refuse to have blind faith in everything that anybody says, and especially in what they don't say. Personal equations in every man's affairs forbids that kind of blind faith. For one example, When Truman appointed Anna Rosenberg to be Assistant Defense Secretary, Fulton Lewis Jr. revealed her entire background in a series of broadcasts. Then the notorious ADL threatened him with their well-known anti-Semitic brand blackmail pressure. And Lewis completely reversed himself and gave her a complete clean bill of political health by broadcasting that the Anna Rosenberg he had been unmasking was a different Annie. He knew that was false, yet he deliberately misled the American people. He admitted he did that because he had been warned that the ADL would pressure his sponsors to cancel their sponsorships and thus drive him off the air. He was faced with the choice of deceiving the American people or losing his voice on the air. He chose to save his voice. Another prime example. Victor Reissel delivered his column to Ronald Reagan to lie to the American people that today there are no Reds left in Hollywood. Reissel knew that was false, yet he deliberately let Reagan delude the American people through their blind faith in him, Reissel, and in the words of his column. I could cite other examples of slips by otherwise loyal to America columnists and commentators. I don't know why they made and still make those slips. Pressure may have forced some to do it. Mawkish sentimentality may have swayed others. With still others, it may have been sheer ignorance about a subject which they had no right to touch. But whatever it was and is, it proves my contention that blind faith in any fallible human being, and believe me, all humans are fallible, can be as dangerous as was our blind faith in a Franklin Roosevelt, who betrayed us at Pearl Harbor and at Yalta, or at Dwight Eisenhower, who delivered Berlin and all of Eastern Europe to Moscow's armies, or a United Nations, who deliberately murdered our sons in Korea and Vietnam, and who will continue to murder our sons with similar betrayals. Anyway, it was that type of trusted columnists that the Hollywood moguls and the masterminds of the great conspiracy chose to whitewash their red stars and brainwash the American people all over again. This came to my attention during the early months in 1953. It came in the form of letters from various TV sponsors who defended the employment of such Reds as Frederick March, Edward G. Robinson, Eddie Cantor, Gene Kelly, etc., in their TV shows. The gist of such letters from the sponsors was that their stars were no longer in the Red category because they had been cleared by a highly respected clearance committee, which also had forgiven those Reds' past sins. Some sponsors also stated that virtually all of the stars listed in the Red Stars tract had thus been cleared and that the tract was no longer valid. That highly respected clearance committee puzzled me. Such clearances, to be authoritative, could come only from the FBI or an official congressional committee. In response to my inquiries, all such official agencies denied having issued such clearances. Nevertheless, that same clearance story was more than just merely hinted by various columnists and commentators. And late in 1953, the people again began to let down their vigilance. All picketing ceased. Circulation of the Red Stars tract began to greatly decline. Protests to sponsors greatly diminished. And the Red Stars began to creep back into Hollywood and flooded into TV. And once again, Red propaganda films became the order of the day, and I still didn't know the identity of that highly respected clearance committee. But early in 1954, a George Sokolsky column let the cat out of the bag. The first paragraph of that column reads as follows, I quote, "For 2 years, Hollywood has been surprisingly clear of communists. After motion pictures were boycotted and theaters picketed by patriotic organizations to prevent American money from filling the treasury of the Communist Party, a program was set up which gave the dupes or innocents or even the communist who had changed his mind an opportunity to clear himself. About 300 persons connected with the industry took advantage of this opportunity to set themselves straight. Surprisingly few of these persons have backslid. It was a good record of work done to help an industry in distress. And it must be said that the principal producers cooperated with the program. End of quote. Wow, what a brainwashing lie. What a brazen plot. I say that because we had named approximately 300 Red Stars writers, directors, and producers. The House Committee on Un-American Activities had named the very same 300. Needless to say, it was that same 300 that Sikorsky and his so-called clearance committee whitewashed in his column. That let the cat out of the bag. It gave me the clue to smoke out the whole plot. Briefly, here is the story. During the congressional hearings following the exposure of the Ronald Reagan spiels that today there are no more Reds in Hollywood, George Sikorsky and none other than James O'Neill, publisher of the American Legion magazine, organized a small, very select group of syndicated columnists into what they called a clearance committee. Naturally, it was done under pressures from the Hollywood moguls, the ADL and the CFR's controlled newspaper publishers. The modus operandi for the clearance was simple. All that any individual, whether it was a Lucille Ball, a Katharine Hepburn, an Edward G. Robinson, or an economy-driven fellow traveler had to do, was write a letter to the committee saying that he or she had seen the light, and he or she was immediately absolved of all sins. And all Hollywood and TV and radio network sponsors were confidentially informed of that fact. It was all done very hush-hush, but by the time we got onto that little scheme, all the Reds who had been officially cited as such were in possession of clearance certificates. And to give nationwide credence to the clearances, many columnists and editorial writers eulogized some of the most flaming Reds for having seen the light, for their honest confessions, and for their earnest, phony pledges to sin no more. Some of them even appealed to the public, as George Sikorsky did, to forgive the repentant sinners, such repentant sinners as Dalton Trumbo, John Howard Lawson, Otto Preminger, the despicable Stanley Kramer, etc. Small wonder that TV sponsors could blandly state to protesting customers that the Reds in their TV shows were no longer Reds, because they had been officially cleared by that clearance committee. Small wonder that Hollywood and TV producers could brazenly reject criticism of their employment of Reds on the ground that their Reds had been cleared. Small wonder that the brainwashed all over again people began to let down their guards and cease their picketings and protests. Small wonder that all the Reds were once again flocking back into Hollywood. Perhaps the most brazen of all the apologists for the Reds was that same Ronald Reagan. After we had torpedoed his There Are No More Reds in Hollywood, he was rewarded with the job of producer of TV shows for General Electric Company, whose head is a member of the CFR. He employed some of the most flaming Reds to star in those shows, and he introduced them as one of my best friends and a great American. Today, he is the governor of California and running like mad to become the Republican candidate for the White House. Aside from the fact that actor Reagan knows as little about running a state or federal government as I do about piloting a submarine, if he gets into the White House, will he likewise eulogize the Ho Chi Minhs, Mao Zedongs, and Brezhnevs as he eulogizes Red Stars in his General Electric TV shows? No doubt he would. While I am on the Reagan subject, I will mention another very significant matter. Many Americans who will hear this record may recall that in the very late 1940s, the masterminds of the Great Conspiracy set up a one-world organization which they called the United World Federalists, more commonly known as the UWF. The job this UWF was set up to do was to bribe and seduce 32 state legislatures to secretly pass resolutions memorializing Congress to transform the United States into a unit of a UN One World Government. By July 1949, they, the UWF, had succeeded in getting 26 state legislatures to secretly pass that treasonous resolution. All they needed was six more states, and our country would have become an enslaved unit in that UN One World Government. It was in that month of July 1949 that we, CEG, launched a statewide crusade to force the California legislature to haul out that UWF resolution for an open to the public review, exactly as Congress should haul in the UN Charter for a similar review. How we, CEG, accomplished it is a story in itself and has no place in this record. But accomplish it, we did. And in March 1950, the California legislature reviewed the UWF resolution, declared it an act of treason, and rescinded the resolution. The first time such a thing had been done in the history of California. The other 25 state legislatures, in fear of the reactions of their constituents, promptly followed California's example. That's how close we came to lose our country. Only the fight put up by the Cinema Educational Guild saved us. That UWF outfit of treason was organized by 42 of the most notorious and flaming Reds in the country. But my chief reason for mentioning that incident is that Ronald Reagan was through the years a member of the board of directors of that UWF cabal of treason. And he is the man who wants to be the president of the United States. While I'm at it, there's another point. Mrs. Ronald Reagan, known in the Hollywood professional circles as Nancy Davis, joined a score or more of Hollywood red-hot Reds in signing an amicus curiae which contained a plea for clemency for Dalton Trumbo and John Howard Lawson of the infamous Hollywood Ten. And she, too, wants to be a first lady of the land in the White House. Shades of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. But now, back to that clearance committee. As soon as we had all the facts, we, CEG, again roared back into the fight. We issued a special bulletin in which we hurled back into the teeth of Sikorsky, James O'Neill, and their committee colleagues all their brazen lies that for 2 years, Hollywood had been surprisingly clean of communists and communist activities by naming more than a score of films issued during those very 2 years that befouled America even more than did Mission to Moscow. As on previous similar occasions, we flooded the nation with that special bulletin. And as before, a reawakened and infuriated people came roaring back into the fight. Once again, they employed our Red Star tracts, millions of them, to force a showdown with Hollywood, with TV, and with Congress. So once again, we beheld a parade of the Red Stars, writers, directors, producers, before a congressional committee. Among them, all those who, according to the clearance committee, had expressed sincere regret for their past misdeeds and had vowed never again to become involved with communistic activities. But there were no expressions of repentance or recantations when those supposedly cleared Reds appeared before the congressional committee. When asked the various $64,000 questions, they all jumped behind the Fifth Amendment. Naturally, those hearings torpedoed the phony clearance committee and the equally phony clearance certificates. They torpedoed all the alibis of the sponsors and the producers. And once again, we beheld a hasty exodus of panic-stricken Reds out of Hollywood. Now, unquestionably, many Americans who will hear these records, but who never read any of our news bulletins and special bulletins, or have not seen our Red Stars tracked, will be amazed by all of the revelations in these records. They will probably find our revelation of that clearance committee plot unbelievable because of the men involved in it, especially a top official, James O'Neill, of the American Legion, an organization created and dedicated to work for the safety and security of our country. But it is all a matter of official recording in the congressional records and front-page reportings of those years. Why such previously highly regarded men lent their prestige to such a dastardly plot, whether they were pressured, intimidated, or bribed into it, is unimportant. The point that is very important is that they did it, and that others of equal standing have been and are being caught red-handed in similar activities. And that brings me to the point I wish to stress in this record, and to show why this record is invaluable at this time. Ever since 1949, our Red Stars tract, reinforced by our bulletins, has been the one, the only one, impassable roadblock to the Reds and the CFR's complete conquest of Hollywood TV and radio. But since the late 1950s, there have been no congressional investigations of Hollywood and TV. Hence, absolutely no front page alertings. Whether the congressional committees have been bribed, seduced, or intimidated, the fact remains that there has been no official investigations of the Reds in Hollywood or in TV or in radio since 1956. As a result, today both Hollywood and TV are again seeding and crawling with Reds. The Katharine Hepburns, Lucille Balls, Frederick Marches, Edward G. Robinsons, Dalton Trumbos, the Melvin Douglases, all the Reds we had driven off the screens, big and little, are back again. And tragically, the vast majority of the American people seemingly have forgotten the communist backgrounds of all those many time exposed Reds and are flocking to their films. And seemingly, they, the people, do not realize that the films they are patronizing and supporting today are even more viciously communistic than Song of Russia, Gentleman's Agreement, Mission to Moscow, and all the Red films of earlier years. And even more horrible, during the past 10 years, they have been producing films directly aimed to destroy the morale of our nation, particularly our youth. Films that glorify hippies, that eulogize and encourage racial strife. Films that subtly encourage lawlessness and riotings in the streets. In short, every kind of film that glorifies communism and denigrates Americanism. Each one produced, written, and directed by Reds. Each one starring flaming Reds who had been driven off the screen time after time after time. I do not have space or time in this record to name the scores of Red propaganda and filth films now being shown all over the country and throughout the world. But I will name one that has just been released. The title of it is Look Who's Coming to Dinner, a filmization of one of the most salacious books ever written. It was produced and directed by Stanley Kramer, one of the most flaming Reds in the film industry. Its stars are Katharine Hepburn and Sidney Poitier, two of the most flaming Reds in Hollywood. This film depicts the love story of a black boy and a white girl. In the telling of it, the black man, portrayed by Poitier, is endowed with all the virtues and human decencies, whereas the white man, played by Spencer Tracy, who recently died, is depicted as a vile, racist, and bigot. And this is just one of many such films, all devoted to one objective: destroy the American way of life.
Please turn your tape.
Okay, and that's the end of that. It goes on into how the Reds have influenced radio and television, that kind of thing. But for now, we'll just stop there because there's not enough time to get into that second part. I will post this on the Information Corner within the next few days, and you can look for it there if you want to hear it in its entirety.
It may take a few days, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know.
But, folks, you can see just how far we've slipped since that was recorded in the 60s.
Yeah, now you can understand how the UN has taken foothold as far as with Agenda 21.
Right, and the thing I want to stress here is that this world government thing has been going on for a long time. Now, you saw how unrelenting he was when he got into the fight. Myron Fagan kept coming back time and time again with the people that he had helping him in this fight to expose the Reds. Folks, we cannot lay down and give up. As weary as we may get, we cannot lay down and give up. We must stay in the fight and do what we can to spare this land that we love so much. Because, folks, this is the only place we got to live. You can't run anywhere else. Will we win? Only God knows that. And that's why we always say at the end of our broadcast, you know, go out and fight the battle and let God decide the outcome. Because we don't know if we're going to win this thing or not. We're just supposed to be out here fighting. But you can do some things through prayer, you know. I mean, it's perfectly okay to pray. Scripture even tells us that, to pray for the confusion of the enemy.
Yeah, boy, we sure need that.
And we do need that, definitely. But these recordings that Myron Fagan did are absolutely some of the most valuable pieces of work that have ever been recorded in modern history.
And I'm glad that we here have been able to share some of that with you tonight. And it shows you just how this conspiracy to pull us into a world government has been alive and well. And these records are invaluable for another reason, too, because this man was in the industry, and he knows it.
He knew it, yeah.
He knew it then. And, folks, anytime somebody says that we're crazy, this is one man who was on our side.
Yeah.
And you notice how the ADL was involved in the racial slander and all kinds of stuff back in those days, calling people anti-Semitic. That was going on even back in those days.
That's
just like
new,
it is now.
It?
It's nothing new under the sun. We're just the next group of people walking through this mess. And until some of these groups are exposed for what they really are and are dealt with, we're going to have this fight on our hands, and we're going to continue to have this fight. And we may fight this for the rest of our lives, but always
sure.
Remember, there's another generation coming, and they need a good place to live. And do we want to leave the world in worse shape, or certainly this nation in worse shape than it was when we found it? Our job is to remain vigilant and to stand up and fight for freedom until we take our last breath. So there's no point in trying to give up. I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm making a very small difference here, but I found that just working in my own local area, I'm educating a lot of people through the little radio station I've started here. People's mouths are literally falling open with this information that we're presenting here, and they're finding out for the first time just how far they've been deceived. Who's listening? We don't know. There's a lot. We know of a few that are listening, but there's a heck of a lot of closet listeners that we found out that we understand. And now we just have to try to get those people not to be so worried about coming out of the closet. Let us know you're out there. Hey, you know, it's your duty as an American to stand up for your country.
But some people, you know, rather kind of work behind the scenes, and I can understand.
Well,
that
and that's
too.
Fine. I mean, you know, for some, but I mean, yeah. We do have to stand up and defend what God has given us, and the way to defend it is not always with guns and bullets all the time. You know, sometimes you have to do other things as well. You know, so we sure hope that you got a lot out of this. We sure enjoyed bringing it to you, and the only thing I wish is that we could have finished it. But anyway, it's been our pleasure for sitting in. It's been our pleasure sitting in for Chris Gerner tonight.
Make sure you keep Chris in your prayers. You know,
absolutely.
He's been under the weather. And
he's not feeling well. And our thanks again to Nicholas for running the network there. And also our thanks to Melody Cedarstrom for supporting Chris's efforts here.
And thanks to Darren for such a great job on Chris's website, which is
American Exposé, American spelled with a K and not a C, AmericanExposé.com. And that's going to do it for us. I'm Sam.
And I'm Trish.
And we thank you once again for listening tonight. God bless you all, and stay in the fight, because it may be a long, long battle. See you later. And as we always say,